A Sustainable Mind, Episode 2. This is A Sustainable Mind podcast, where we delve into the minds behind today's most impactful environmental campaigns, organizations, and startups, inspiring the environmental changemakers of tomorrow. I'm your host, Marjorie Alexander. Today, I am super excited to welcome to the show Katrina Spade. Katrina is an architect with a background in anthropology and has won several awards, including a fellowship from Echoing Green for the Urban Death Project. I could not pass up the opportunity to interview the mind behind it all. So, Katrina, take it away.
Thank you so much. So, yes, like you said, I'm the founder and director of the Urban Death Project, which is an alternative to cremation and burial that uses the process of composting to turn us into soil. It is pretty simple, actually, when you get right down to it. And I like that you said I have won many awards. I'm not sure I've won any except for that one very important fellowship, but perhaps someday I'll get to say I've won many awards.
I think I saw one more on here. I didn't write it down, there, of course.
That's true. There are a couple of, you know what it is? There's a couple of second place
honorable
mentions that are on there. But actually, that's one of the things I often say to young people, like my kids, when they're thinking about trying to do something. I got a lot of rejections for this project before getting the Echoing Green Fellowship, which really launched things for me. But I did a lot of sending out applications for awards and grants and getting lots of no's. Mm-hmm. And that's important, I think.
Excellent. So I'm going to rewind the clock here a little bit and go back to your childhood, because what I'm finding is that a lot of people who are seeking to live a little more lightly on this planet for whatever reason, whether it's in their business or just in their personal life, have a connection with that at some point in their childhood. So tell us a little bit about how sustainability played a role for you growing up.
Well, I grew up in rural New Hampshire and on a dead-end dirt road. And it's interesting because I'm definitely a city dweller at heart. Once I moved to near the city outside of Philadelphia at 18, I was done with rural living. In fact, I love visiting nature, but I don't love living in it. Mm-hmm. But so it's funny, but I think at the same time, my upbringing in this rural existence was really important to just sort of like my overall way of being, for sure. My parents gardened a lot. They both had full-time jobs, but they also grew most of our vegetables. Even we froze them through the winter. So, and we always had a couple of animals, some of which, like the pigs and the cows, we would eat after a certain amount of time. So there was sort of a connection to the land that I got from living in New Hampshire. So my mother, she's always been sort of this quiet but powerful environmentalist in my mind. She took on the a campaign in my hometown in Plainfield, New Hampshire, to create a town mollusk and a town beetle that would be sort of the official town bug and mollusk, which is in this case a mussel. So that because these were two endangered species that lived on the Connecticut River near our town, and there was so talk about damming the Connecticut River, and this one little island would be flooded. And so she really took this on, and she made a whole campaign, and now the town has an official town veto, an official town mollusk, and the damming was thwarted. So I think I have some of that as well.
So fast forwarding to the Urban Death Project, what was kind of the light bulb that came on that prompted you to start this journey?
I was in architecture school at a slightly later age. I think I began at 32. And I have two young children who were very young at the time. And I actually had a moment. I remember very specifically watching them run around in the backyard. Well, one of them couldn't even run around yet. But and thinking, God, they really grow up in front of your very eyes. Like every day they're a little bit older. Almost, you can almost see it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized that if that were the case, like if they were growing at this rapid pace, then I too must be growing at the same pace, not physically, but just time-wise. And it really just hit me that I was going to die someday. I mean, some people realize that earlier on. Some people never realize it until it happens. But it's true. We're all going to die someday. It's such an obvious thing to say in a way, but it's also weirdly radical to say it out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And so being in architecture school, I started looking into what would happen to my body when I died. Partly because my family and my friends are mostly non-religious. And so there's no kind of religious guidance that would occur from a priest or a rabbi saying, okay, now your loved one has died. Here's what you should do with her body. So I thought, well, what would they do? And I started looking into the options. And I just was really unimpressed by the options out there. Both conventional burial and cremation have an environmental toll or take an environmental toll in different ways. They're wasteful and or polluting. And so I thought, geez, I don't think I want that to be my last gesture on this earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, a friend of mine told me about this research that's been happening for the last few decades in livestock composting. So composting on farms of large animals. And it just clicked.
That's very interesting. I've never considered that animals would be composted. Is this something that's practiced on a large scale? Is it practiced on organic farms versus, you know, non-organic farms? I've never actually heard of that.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about it is the composting of livestock was born out of the decline of the rendering industry on a small scale. So if you had 100 head of cattle 50 years ago, and one or two of them died of something, and they weren't fit to eat, like, so maybe they died of a disease or something like that, you might call the rendering person who would come and take your animals off your hands, and then turn it into glue or soap. The rendering industry is now on such a large industrial scale that a small farmer can't find someone to come and take their animal away. And so they were kind of having trouble either burying them, and then when the animal decomposed, there would be this sort of like sinkhole in their backyard, or they might toss it on the back 40, and then scavengers would get to it, and the femur would end up on their neighbor's porch. So it's kind of this issue that farmers were having: what to do with your dead animals if you can't slaughter them for food. And so a bunch of agricultural institutions, like including Washington State University. I mean, there's a ton of them, but Cornell is one of the also sort of well-known ag universities, started studying how to compost animals. And it's very effective, very sustainable, and kills most pathogens as well. So it's actually a way to just turn your animal back into the land.
I think it's really interesting that people are uncomfortable with the concept of composting. I, for one, am a big proponent of composting toilets. And some people are so, whenever I say that, I mean, their eyes just roll in the back of their head. But the thing that's interesting about it is that pretty much all natural resources have gone through some process of renewal, whether it's composting that only takes a couple months or a couple years, or the process of forming, you know, oil or coal or diamonds. I mean, it's all a system of organic materials being put into the earth, and under heat and pressure, these natural resources are created for us, whether it's, you know, soil that we can grow vegetables in, or oil that we use to run our cars. It's all created through the same kind of concept and process, just some are longer than others. So
that's a great point, yeah.
It's interesting to me that some people are uncomfortable with it, but on that point, have you run into any issues of legality since it's human remains as opposed to animal remains, or, you know, like vegetable, organic material, things like that?
Well, we haven't. I wouldn't say I've run into legal problems, but definitely. So the Urban Death Project is a nonprofit organization for many reasons, but so that basically we have programs that we're working on.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of organize the programs into testing and research, design and engineering, outreach and education. And then the fourth is legal and regulatory. right now you could sort of say that human composting is not legal.
Okay.
There's nothing out there that says you can't compost a human being. At the same time, there's nothing written into the laws that allow it. So, what you can do with a human body is allowed on a state-by-state level. And for most states, they list cremation, burial, or donation to science as the available options for the disposition of remains. So we are right now actually trying to figure out how to add human composting to that list, what the easiest strategy is. We know that it's a really, really effective way of transforming a human body into another material, in this case, compost. And it's a little bit more like cremation in that way than it is like burial, even though it seems burial-ish because it has to do with the soil. I consider it more like a process like cremation in a way. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually, the great thing about this project has been all the collaborations that come up with other people and organizations. So in this case, Wake Forest University Law School, one of the professors there is taking on with her students the question of how to best strategize the legal issue. So it's like I get to turn it over to a bunch of law students in a cemetery and funeral course, thank goodness. But it is a question. I mean, you're right to ask it. And I don't think it's going to be like the biggest challenge or the biggest obstacle, but I think it's definitely obviously something that we need to figure out the strategy for and then make happen. And maybe the hardest part is just that it will be state by state. So each state will need to amend its laws. And that's a lot of state, so that's anytime someone wants to build an urban death project facility in a new state will have to go through this sort of same legal process.
What do people say to you or ask you, or what's the look on their face when you first tell them about this? People that don't know you, you meet them at some event or, out on the street somewhere. I mean, what are people's reactions to you telling them about this project?
Some people say, oh, I've heard of that. It's being done, right? And then I say, not quite yet. So in a way, I think of that as being is having to do with the fact that it seems so obvious that it's surprising it's not happening yet, which mm-hmm. is, I think, a good sign for it in the long run. But then it definitely can stop a dinner party. And then the rest of the dinner party is talking about death and dying and stuff like that. So sometimes I'm trying to think of like the answer that I should have when I just don't want to talk about it.
Right.
But I don't have that answer.
You don't have that answer yet?
No, but I should just make something up.
I think that would be a good thing to do. So at the beginning of putting this whole thing together, was there anything that was really holding you back from putting this project in motion, like on a personal level?
No, not really. There was a real evolution of the project. I mean, it really began as a design exercise that spanned 2.5 years, but still, that was really about it. I'm so grateful that it was about this. It was never from the beginning, what would be a good business plan or how could I make this work in reality? Mm-hmm. It began as, what do humans need to grieve and say goodbye to loved ones? And what would a good system be to turn our bodies into something else after we've died? It was really about the design and never about the reality of it at first, which I'm so grateful for because it meant I just sort of went there all the way. But there was nothing really holding me back. It was really an evolution in that I started to think about these things, found out about livestock composting, spent a few years designing, and then once I graduated from architecture school, started throwing it out in the world. Like, I think of it as it was kind of like tossing softballs, a lot of which got tossed right back. But like grant applications, emails to people, including like soil scientists and funeral directors in the Seattle area and beyond, people who I thought would be able to help. And those softballs, for the most part, have been really, really fruitful, to mix metaphors. But yeah.
Actually, I put this on my list of questions because I know we're talking about composting and you seem like a good-humored person, so I can ask you. Some of the people that I interview are really serious, and I would not dare ask them this, but if you were any vegetable or fruit, what would you be and why?
Whoa. Let's see. That is a hard one to just come up with right away. I'm thinking artichoke for some reason right now. I'm not sure why.
I love artichokes.
I love artichokes, so too.
I'm good with that answer. So to get back to the Urban Death Project, what is one of the most, I guess, unexpected gifts that you've received from working through this idea, from introducing it to the public, and, you know, basically getting recognized for it on an international scale? What's kind of the most unexpected thing that you were like, you know what, I'm really happy that I did this, and this is why?
I think the biggest thing's been talking about death and dying on a daily basis is actually really, in a weird way, it's comforting, and it's not depressing. And I think it really has reminded me to, as much as possible, live in the moment, because you just never know when that will be your last. And then sort of connected to that has been meeting all of these amazing people who are doing work in the alternative death care space.
Mm-hmm.
So from death end of life celebrants to funeral directors who are trying to do things differently and with more transparency to, I don't know, there's a really amazing group of people that are trying to make home funerals more available to people. So that's been really awesome. And I didn't know that would happen.
Well, that just goes to show you that, you know, regardless of your background or your industry or your current job, you really can find a way to get involved with more sustainable living, or in this case, more sustainable death practices. So I think a lot of people are, you know, they think that environmental sustainability is like this one field or this one profession, and, you know, you're either in it or you're not. And one thing that I've learned, because I have a background in filmmaking, and at first I felt like I kind of had my feet in these two totally separate things. And, you know, I was kind of doing the splits because I felt like they were so far apart. But one reason why I really am excited to do this project is because I feel like I'm able to bring these two things that I really love, which is media and environmental sustainability, together. Combining those two is really awesome. So you mentioned that you had kids.
Yes, I have two children.
How old are they?
They are 7 and 10 now, which is hard for me to believe sometimes when I say it, but those are great ages because they can feed and clothe themselves, and they're still a lot of fun to be with.
So it's kind of in that nice little sweet spot where you don't have to be tending to them all the time. That's awesome. What has the Urban Death Project, what kind of impact has it had on their lives? Do they know what you do? And, you know, how do you talk about it with them?
They definitely know what I do. Mostly they think I get way too much screen time because I'm always on my computer. But mm-hmm. I'm like, you know what? Most people are always on their computer.
Right.
So, like, that's the biggest thing they notice about my job, because I work from home, so they sort of see me doing it more often. They wish they could have as much screen time as I do. And I'm like, I don't think that would be a good idea. But kids are so able to talk about things like death. I mean, they just, it's really grown-ups that have the trouble with it. And that sort of, as we get older, we take on all of society's weirdness around the fact that we're going to die someday, and there then will be, you know, a dead body to take care of. And as we get older, we take that on more and more, I think. And the kids don't have that at all, and they I think they get that in a deeper way than, or not a deeper way, but just an easier way. So they can describe the project pretty well. I don't know, at first when they were littler, it was like sort of mind blowing when they did it, because it was like these adorable little chubby faced kids talking about something so deep and meaningful
mm-hmm.
and so taboo. Now that they're a little older, I feel like they've actually heard me too many times, and they're almost just like repeating. It's not as mind-blowing, but it's still, they're good. They're good with it.
How do you incorporate sustainable living habits into your current lifestyle, and how are your kids involved with that?
Well, I'm not sure. Let's see. I'm not sure that we do a ton that's beyond the pale. We live in the city in the middle of Seattle, and we live with two other, so my partner and I and two other adults and our kids live here. So it's, you know, but it feels like a big house. We all four adults share one car, but we live in a city, so that's not really that amazing. And my mom is so sad because we have like a compost bucket in our kitchen, which of course we fill with kitchen scraps, but then we give that compost, those scraps away to the city. They have, in Seattle, you have curbside pickup. And my mom's always like, just giving it away, giving it away. But I'm happy to give it to the city to make really good compost with, so. And yeah, I don't know what we do. I mean, our kids are really aware. Sometimes our kids shame us about leaving the lights on, you know, so they're definitely really aware of energy use and all that. And we had a lot of discussion yesterday about the air conditioner in the car versus windows creating drag and mm-hmm. which would use more gas. And we now know the answer, thanks to Google.
What is the answer? I have no idea.
Well, apparently, if you're going more than 55 miles an hour, you want to use air conditioning will use less gasoline.
Ah.
If you're going below 55, it's a little bit more than the drag. So actually that's kind of perfect, because on the highway when it's really loud, you can roll up the windows and use the air conditioning. And when you're driving around the city, you can just have natural ventilation.
Well, that's good, because August is coming up, and on my way home from work, I don't have to feel bad about, you know, not rolling my windows down. So that's perfect. Okay, so this is what I like to call the lightning round.
Oh,
it's
God.
Where... No, don't worry. It's super easy questions, and you can take like 30 to 60 seconds each to answer.
Great. Okay.
All right. So what is the best advice that you've ever received?
Someone once told me that you're a different person when you're 8 and 18 and 28 and 38, that you can actually you don't have to see it all as one exact trajectory. And I'm not sure if I fully believe it, but it's kind of helpful sometimes to think about like really these like different times in your life, different eras, and you're actually a different person. I don't know why that's so comforting to me, but it is. It's not really advice though.
So can you share one of your long-standing habits that you believe has drastically improved your life?
Okay, long-standing habits. I have always done some, this is so boring. I've always done some form of exercise. Usually my favorite thing to do is sport. But when I can't do a sport, I will go for a jog. And I hate jogging. I think it's super boring. But the difference in my mental state before and after I jog is so pronounced. Like, I highly recommend anyone who hasn't, just try it. And then, even though it's bad, it's not fun, but it's like 25 minutes. And the other thing I say is, if you think jogging hurts, which it does at first, do it for 3 weeks, 3 times a week, and I promise it will stop hurting. That's all. I have a real feeling about this.
All right.
I hate it, but I love it.
Very good. What is one new habit that you're cultivating in your life right now?
I'm trying to cultivate a little more downtime. Downtime being something where I'm actually not really doing anything.
Nothing at all. Just being.
Just like sitting around and chit-chatting, maybe.
Chit-chatting. Okay.
Yeah.
So more chit-chatting in life. Very good.
More chit-chatting.
Okay. So here's an odd one that kind of stops people in their tracks a little bit. What is one purchase you've made in the last 6 months for less than $100 that has greatly impacted your life?
That is a tough one. I'm going to have to say, I'm going to say a tennis racket. For $29, you can buy a tennis racket. And then you can play a game. And I think games are really important.
Well, definitely being physically active is, as you mentioned earlier, is it does a lot for your headspace, for your physical well-being. If your younger self had access to a time machine and could travel to the present to speak with you, what would she say or ask?
I think I would tell myself to not worry about, like, to not be so hard on myself about sort of my natural inclination or my sort of way. I think when I was younger, I felt like I was too scattered or that I like to do too many things at one time. And as I've gotten older, I've realized that while that's good to kind of work on and think about, it's also a skill to be able to think about a bunch of things at one time and to sort of hold them all and work on things concurrently. So I think I would tell myself to be a little gentler on myself.
Do you have an internet resource that you can share with our listeners?
For sustainability stuff?
Yeah, for sustainability stuff, something that you find super helpful, but is like something that somebody might not necessarily think of off the top of their head.
Well, I think I'm just going to plug a tiny bit one of my favorite places in the world, which is called Yestermorrow Design Build School. And they have a website, yestermorrow.org. But the thing that's so amazing about this place, is, and it's been around for 35 years now, is it's a place where you can completely get hands-on with sustainability stuff. So, like, you could go there and take a weekend course and learn how to create a home wastewater system, like, using natural flora. You know, you could go there and learn about solar panels and systems, go there and design your own permaculture garden or a permaculture homestead for that matter. So I think if you really like to take it to the next level, and just the thing about that's so awesome is just getting hands-on and the empowerment that comes from learning how to do something yourself. And that's the place for you.
Absolutely. And I will say that that is one of my favorites as well. And I do plan on taking a tiny house building course with them next year.
Yes, that's awesome.
What book would you recommend to sustainable minds out there that are hoping to shift their mindset to become the change that they want to see in the world?
This is going to be a little bit of an odd answer, but there's a book called The World Without Us by Alan Wiseman that really shaped the way I was thinking about the Urban Death Project. And it's a little bit of an intense book because it's basically like speculative science or fiction, science fiction, but not science fiction, mm-hmm. fiction about science, where the author basically imagines what would happen to the world if humans disappeared one day completely off the face of the earth. And it's very bleak in a way, you know, nuclear reactors shut down and, you know, terrible things happen. At the same time, there's this wonderful chapter on New York City where you start to realize how quickly nature would take back over if humans were gone. And so it's like at the same time, it's bleak and very hopeful. So I highly recommend reading that. It's also just a great book.
Wonderful. Thank you for that.
Sure.
It has been a very long journey for you from start to finish, and if you could take only 12 months to duplicate the amount of success that you've experienced with the Urban Death Project, what would you do differently?
Well, you know, the truth is, like, this project is still in its infancy, I think, or maybe it's like a tween right now. So I don't think things could have gone much faster than they did, honestly. I sometimes feel like I'm just hanging on and steering a ship that is moving at this point on its own because people want it to happen. So not to evade the question, but I just don't think it could happen much faster than it already has.
No, that's actually a good answer, and I think that when I speak to people who I feel are super successful, they usually come back at me with this answer of like, well, I'm still in it. I don't feel like I've reached this point. I don't,
yeah,
you know. So actually, that doesn't surprise me at all. And I definitely want to see where this whole thing ends up, because as uncomfortable as death is to think about for myself, the concept of human composting is something that I've been considering for a few years myself. So I'm excited to see what happens in the near future with this project. But to go back to, so since you're kind of like in the middle of it right now, what are some of the tools and the resources that you've been able to use in the business or the project that you found the most helpful? Are there specific websites that you've needed to use? Are there specific people that you needed to hire? are there tools or fundamentals that you've had to kind of cultivate that you didn't really imagine, oh, if I'm going to make this project successful, this is something that I need to incorporate?
Yeah, well, I think when I got the Eklund Green Fellowship, I right away turned the project into an organization, into a nonprofit organization. So now I manage the fundraising as well as the design, as you know, as well as the basic sort of administration. And so there are, you know, what's kind of amazing right now is everything is on the cloud and online, and so the tools you have at your fingertips are actually pretty great right now. I would urge anyone listening to sign up for our newsletters, which I send out once a month, and I do that using MailChimp, which is a pretty inexpensive newsletter service, mm-hmm. and really slick, you know, it just makes it easy for me. I think beyond the sort of technical stuff, which again, it makes my job pretty easy from that point of view, I've just been reminded that if you ever want to get something done, that reaching out to the people who are experts mm-hmm. in pieces of what you're trying to do is key. I mean, it's incredible right now on the team as part of the advisory board. We have a soil scientist who's an expert in livestock mortality composting. And another on our advisory board is a human decomposition expert, in forensic anthropology. And then just all the people supporting the project with their skills. I mean, it's just incredible. And it means that my job is really, again, to sort of steer and organize all of this incredible knowledge and all these qualifications to sort of move everything forward. And so just asking people for help. The nice thing about it too is that you can send an email to someone and sort of get a sense of whether they're interested in helping you or talking to you with your project. And they might not be, and that's okay too. So it doesn't really hurt. There's no harm in asking, honestly.
I think you make a very interesting point because, and I'm very guilty of this, I think a lot of people, especially millennials, feel like they want to like go out there on their own and change the world. But what we often forget is that some of the, you know, all of the really impactful leaders of the past had hundreds or thousands or millions of people behind them who also believed in their mission and their vision and who really helped propel things forward. And, you know, so building relationships, asking for help, and then, of course, delegating is a huge part of success when it comes to building a company or, in your case, an organization. It's just a really important thing for people to keep in mind, especially with activism and environmental activism. So I appreciate that you actually brought that up. So any words or parting guidance that you want to give Sustainable Minds out there?
Let's see. What I would say is, I wouldn't say follow your heart. I wouldn't not say follow your heart. Go ahead and follow your heart. But I also really think that if you just follow your gut, that can get you a great distance. And in doing so, also be open to complete changes in what you think you're going to be doing. I mean, you know, if you just kind of approach every day not really knowing exactly what it will bring, and that doesn't mean you can't move forward with something that you're working on. It just means be really open to things morphing. And that's the best advice I have.
Awesome. Where can we find out a little bit more about you and the Urban Death Project?
You can find us at www.urbandeathproject.org.
Excellent. And are you on social media?
Yeah, there's a Facebook page for the project, which is a good place to find out about what's going on. And then also on Twitter at Urban Death Proj, which is spelled P-R-O-J.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Katrina. This has been a lively conversation, which I appreciate because that helps calm my nerves quite a bit, but also super informative. So,
oh, good.
I really appreciate it. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You've been listening to A Sustainable Mind podcast. To hear more interviews just like this one, please subscribe on iTunes or visit asustainablemind.com. Thanks for listening and see you next time.